Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
I'm joined by Pete Weatherby and Clifford Stott, who are two of the authors of the Independent Review into the 2022 UEFA Champions League final and its aftermath. You'll have heard all about it on the Anfield Wrap and in a number of other places, including a lot on Liverpool Football Club's website yesterday, which was very, very good to see indeed. Joined by Pete and Clifford here to go through what was in that report and the ramifications thereof. First and foremost, I want to keep this as future-focused as we can, because a lot of what's in the report, Cliff, is stuff that we sort of had the sense of the morning after. We'll talk about the obfuscation from UEFA and the French authorities, but the Saint-Denis Convention of 2016 looms large through the report. And I think the first thing to do is just to make clear to people what that is, how it came about, but also the fact that it is there as a guiding document, isn't it, to allow authorities, for authorities to agree to, countries to agree to, as to how these sorts of large-scale events should be operated, Cliff.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's got a long history. We obviously need to place Paris in the context of that history, and it takes us back to 1985 and Heysel. Mm-hmm. And one of the outcomes of that stadium disaster was that there was recognition among the authorities that it was a failure of international police cooperation. So what that set in motion was a whole series of agreements between nation states under the framework of the Council of Europe. So that's not the European Union, but the Council of Europe via Strasbourg, to set up a framework of international police cooperation that's evolved since 1985, taking into account learning and development. And it went through quite an important period of development in the early noughties, particularly off the back of Euro 2004. I had quite a lot of involvement in that in terms of injecting some of the science that I do to underpin a model of good policing practice that pushes the direction of travel towards dialogue and engagement with fans and much more softly type policing that takes away that kind of heavy-handedness, which was recognised to be a really powerful problem in the European context. So this agreement, this range of agreements has evolved over time and culminates in the last iteration, which was signed off, ironically, in Saint-Denis, in France in 2016, which sets out a whole range of different levels of policy that relate to how safety, security, and importantly, service need to be delivered at these kinds of fixtures. So what we're looking at is quite a comprehensive and robust policy environment that sits across this, supported by the Council of Europe, to which all of the nation states of Europe have effectively signed up, including France and the UK.
As part of this, Pete, when you come to approach this sort of process, which, let's be clear about this, the eventual review document's 220 pages in scope, the appendices stretch to over 2,000 pages of everything that's in there. It's documents like this, like the Saint-Denis Convention of 2016, which offer the framework to be able to say, in the context of this, the FFF, UEFA, and the French authorities, how they have or haven't achieved what they have previously all agreed to, what everyone has signed up to. And that's why that document in 2016 is a really important one, isn't it, from the point of view of this independent review?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what needs to be pointed out first and foremost is that this is an international treaty. This is a legal document, and it's legally binding. And as Clifford says, it was signed, amongst many others, by the French state. So with respect to Paris, it was binding on the French state, and Articles 4, 5, 6 and 7 require state parties, i.e. the French state, to ensure both event organisers and public authorities, so that would include both UEFA and the French policing authorities, to, quote, provide a safe and secure environment for all participants and spectators, and a welcoming environment for all sections of society, including children, the elderly, and those with disabilities, unquote. So those who were at Paris can see how well the French state ensured that both they and UEFA met their international legal binding obligations under the convention.
When you discussed those provisions, you mentioned 4, 5, and 6 there. I read this only in the context of the report coming out yesterday, and I was, one of the things I was shocked by was actually how straightforward it is. It's a remarkably straightforward document. Every single article couldn't be effectively more streamlined, but couldn't have greater clarity, really, in what the expectations are, Pete. That also stretches into Article 8, which is about engagement with supporters and local communities within this convention agreement of 2016, which very clearly states proactive and regular communication with key stakeholders, supporter representatives, local communities, dialogue, partnership, positive cooperation. And it seems as though, you know, in the context of the UEFA's view of its own Champions League final, the way it views its flagship competition as a festival of football, that partnership, that dialogue, that cooperation should be central to everything that they look to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that underpins the problem that led to what happened in Paris. And you're quite right, Article 8 does say what you've just indicated. Article 9 goes on to say that the parties shall ensure that policing strategies are developed, regularly evaluated and refined consistently with the integrated approach. So the importance of emphasising the word shall is that it's not encourage or guidance, it's binding, and the French state was under an international legal obligation to require the French police to act within the convention.
Within that, Cliff, that then, you know, having gone through the report that you, Pete, and others have pulled together here, paragraph 8.4.2.5 states this: in addition, the Saint-Denis Convention obliges state authorities to work together with organisers. UEFA must be central to how that works with respect to a UCLF Champions League final. Julian Zleiberstein, Managing Director of UEFA European Affairs and Governance, told the Senate hearings of UEFA's involvement with the Saint-Denis Convention and its standing committee, but he was less forthcoming as to why its provisions failed to ensure effective joint working and proper engagement with supporters at UEFA's 2022 flagship event. Indeed, he failed to address that at all. From a beginning to move into a conversation about the recommendations that you've got within this report, but also just an in general things that can change really rather quickly outlook around where UEFA finds itself, that engagement, that effective joint working, those provisions, everything that's in Saint-Denis, they underpin those recommendations. They underpin what was missing in Paris. And they do show a way forward if there is an openness from UEFA to engage about where those failings came in. And that paragraph there distills it into one paragraph.
Yeah, certainly what went wrong. And as Pete points out, I think for me, Article 9 of the convention is really important in that respect, because it talks to us about how the parties, the French state, will ensure that policing strategy take account of good practices. And it lists among those risk-based deployment, proportionate intervention, effective dialogue with supporters and with wider communities, we've already discussed. So where our report is focusing, as you've emphasised there, on a failure of joint working, that's also a polite way of describing the fact that the police acted unilaterally. And they acted unilaterally in a way that was completely inconsistent with the guidance set out in the convention. They assumed that risk and threat was inherent to Liverpool fans. They took a public order-focused, securitized position in relationship to the policing. And in effect, their emphasis on that then led them to herd Liverpool fans into an environment that was potentially fatally unsafe. And they must have been aware of that. They must have had an opportunity to assess that the threat and risk to the well-being of those supporters was at risk, and they failed to act upon that. So we can see lots and lots of failures in the policing here that are playing a primary role in how the events on the ground play themselves out. And that failure is a failure of the implementation of the application of the convention.
And can I just add to that, that overlying that is that on the one hand, the French state has the, that obligation legally and internationally. But one of our key findings was that UEFA, as the event owner, was in, at the wheel and was in a position to require stakeholders or to escalate where stakeholders were public authorities. So if they were failing to get cooperation from the police or a proper dialogue with the police, or they spotted things that the police were failing to do in the planning stage, then they should have escalated up it up through the French state, right up to President Macron's office. And as we know, President Macron played a part in moving the match in the first place to the French to Paris.
To Paris.
Yeah. Just going back to the passage about Julian Silberstein, the point that the panel was making about Julian Silberstein was that the two UEFA representatives who went to the French Senate, Martin Callan, who is the CEO of UEFA Events SA, and Julian Silberstein, the Managing Director of UEFA European Affairs and Governance, went there, and they were, let's say, economical with the actualité, a legal term you might have heard before, in terms of what they said about previous problems at Champions League finals at the Stade de France. But the point we pick up here from Mr. Silberstein is that he was very keen to showboat about UEFA's involvement with the convention. And I don't have any particular disagreement with him that UEFA's played a role in the development of these provisions. But what he then fails to do is he fails to mention at all the fact that Paris was an object lesson in the non-application of the convention by UEFA, by the police, by the French state. And that's the point that we were making.
And if I can, let me just follow on from that as well, because the other point that we make, and this I think relates to one of the last recommendations, is that this failure is not isolated to the Champions League finals. This kind of failure to implement the convention is going on right, left and centre across fixtures that UEFA is responsible for as the event owner, and there needs to be a wider rollout of addressing this question.
And when I think you monitoring say, Pete, and compliance and enforcement of the convention as well, that it's all very well to have such a, as you said, Neil, such a clear set of binding rules. But if the compliance and enforcement mechanisms aren't there, then this, I'm afraid, is the result.
So my question then becomes, why? And it's ever so slightly outside the scope of the report, in a sense. But the why and the how of how we've reached this point, Pete, you know, you mentioned there about UEFA being at the wheel. For me, you know, reading the report, reading the convention documents, reading the report, having been to football matches, some of which fall into, not just this one, I hasten to add, others which fall into the category of most definitely fallen short on the Saint-Denis Agreement, it makes me wonder whether or not this is just an accumulation of there being a complacency around the way in which football supporters are treated in a European context. And I would say, you know, even still in a UK context, that there is a complacency around it and that this is just some sort of end point as to where that amasses. But that's my guess. Why do you think we end up with a document that is as damning as this one, about this many failings and so few people prepared to take responsibility both at the time and then obviously in retrospect?
I think that UEFA has focused on other things and they have, they're prepared to pay lip service to the supporters, but very often they're falling down on that. And, you know, our key finding that they marginalised their own safety and security unit shows that they were focused on all sorts of other things, but they were trying to outsource, delegate to both the private sector through FFF and the public sector by deferring to the police and just abdicating their own responsibility to supervise, monitor, have oversight of safety and security. And I think that just shows a mindset that they just don't see that they have a role with providing the service to supporters. They want to outsource it to others. Cliff, do you?
Well, there is a history there, though, and it is important to take that history into account, and it relates to jurisdiction. So, I mean, to all intents and purposes, UEFA is responsible for the stadium footprint, the event. So there is an issue here about the extent to which UEFA can tell police forces what to do in terms of how they approach the policing of public space outside of the event itself. And that historically has been a challenge that it's been necessary to address primarily through the convention. In a sense, that's why the convention is there, because it creates this framework that allows for a more coherent connection between the security and safety approach taken outside the event to that taken inside it, because it crosses this jurisdictional boundary where UEFA historically has not really had the authority. So that's, in my mind, why in the language of our report, we're talking about soft power. And what we emphasise is UEFA has considerable soft power to influence that. And there are questions here to say, well, look, if you've got a place like France, like Spain, like Italy, where supporters go and consistently face really hostile forms of policing and are placed into circumstances where their safety is brought into question, why are UEFA not exercising their considerable authority, their considerable soft power to influence things in the direction of travel towards a more adequate application of the convention?
And why don't you think they are?
Well, I think Pete hits the nail on the head, really, by talking about the model of devolution, that's ultimately what's at fault here, this idea that UEFA as an organisation can simply devolve and walk away. But I think, Pete, you obviously comment this on yourself, but, I mean, I think what we're identifying is that happens because by walking away, UEFA protects itself from any form of accountability. So it's not really UEFA's problem anymore. It's just taking that model.
That certainly appears to have been the aim, but as we found, it was very misplaced because they couldn't walk away from their responsibility, and we have, I think, held them accountable for it. I mean, the model of delegating to the FFF and deferring to the French police wasn't wrong, as long as you put the crucial central bit in, which was UEFA maintaining an oversight and monitoring point. I mean, UEFA aren't there on the ground, so it's there's nothing wrong. In fact, it's required under French law that the FFF would be the event, to be part of the event. And of course, as Cliff says, that UEFA doesn't have jurisdiction over the French police. But this soft power that Cliff has just mentioned shouldn't be misunderstood. Soft power can be a lot more powerful than black letter law, actual laws passed by Parliament. So we're not in the report saying that UEFA should just have used some fluffy round the edges influence. What we're saying is that UEFA is massively powerful. I mean, ultimately, what I think comes out of this report is that UEFA should be politely saying to states during the bidding process, look, we're not having this. We are not going to put the safety of supporters or anybody else at risk. So you either comply with the convention and give us very key guarantees, and we will be watching throughout, or we'll take our ball elsewhere. And then it's very easy for UEFA to do that. They don't have to give Turkey the 2023 Champions League final or whoever the next one is. They can simply limit it to countries which apply the convention.
Just to pick up on that point as well, is that I've had the opportunity to be involved in the planning phases for two major European championships, Euro 2004 and then the 2012 in Poland, Ukraine. One of the things that I took from my work in those periods was the massive amount of power that UEFA had. I mean, they were more powerful than any government in Europe in terms of shaping policy and practice in relationship to their tournaments, because, of course, there's a massive commercial imperative that they're exercising here, which is incredibly attractive and powerful in its own right to those nation states. And there is considerable opportunity for UEFA to exercise that power and authority in relationship to a broader array of events.
All this brings us on to the recommendations. And first and foremost, Pete, I want to speak about recommendation one. Recommendation one, as far as I can see in there, is very much there off the back of previous experience I suspect you've had, in fact, I know you've had, and previous experience that I think a lot of people who've been involved in panels like this have had over time around the way in which often recommendations happen, recommendations are put in there, but how they are then followed up, what the process is of seeing where the progress is around those recommendations often just sort of goes to seed over a period of time and there's no way of checking. Recommendation one, Pete, is there, isn't it, to ensure that that does not happen on this occasion?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the history of inquiries and reviews is a history of very worthy, detailed work, coming up with reports with hard-hitting conclusions and then translating that into very good recommendations. There's a big upsurge of interest for 2 or 3 days, and then it's put on a shelf and people then just forget about the recommendations, either on purpose or just because they move on to something else. So that is a real serious problem. I can give you a really good example, really very sad example, that the inquests into the deaths at Lackenall House, a fire in a tower block in London, were forgotten about. The recommendations were forgotten about after the inquest. And if they hadn't been forgotten about, then the Grenfell Tower fire shouldn't have happened if the recommendations had been implemented. But that is the history, as I say, of inquiries and reviews. So it was imperative for us to have recommendation one, to do what we could to ensure that the other 20 recommendations would not be forgotten. So as an ad hoc inquiry, if you like, what we have done is we've essentially required UEFA to publicly post an action plan a few weeks from now. So we've kept it as tight as we can because we want it to be before the next Champions League final, but we wanted to give them a little bit of time to reflect. So by the 8th of May, we've asked UEFA to post on their website this action plan saying what they've done about the other 20 recommendations. Now, of course, we have no hard power to require that, but the soft power we discussed earlier is through people like you or the media and politicians and supporter groups and clubs and sponsors and broadcasters and no doubt panel members from this review who will all remind UEFA on the 8th of May if they don't post such a document. And then it requires UEFA to update that as we go along. So that's the best we can do to ensure that recommendations are not simply forgotten.
Within that recommendation, Pete, you do allow the room for them to, for instance, you know, the final line of it is considers and rejected with reasoning. Yeah. So it's not as simple as, and that's an important sort of subclause in there, that they do get the opportunity to do that if they choose to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of the stuff that we've made recommendations on, you know, requires some thinking about. And if, you know, if we have got one of them wrong, for example, or they can come up with something better, then they can say so. I mean, you know, we don't have any power to direct them to do stuff. So they are recommendations. But the reason that's in there is that we're trying to stop them just saying, well, we've considered all the recommendations, thanks very much. What we're saying is either consider them and tell the world that you've implemented them and how, or we've considered the recommendation and this one we've rejected because. And then the world, the sponsors, the supporters can actually see the basis for what they're doing.
It seems, I'll come back to you one more time on it, Pete, both with that recommendation, but also in general reading through the report, one of the things that comes up over and over in the recommendations, but also in the report, is the importance of transparency, of review, of also review when things go well. We all know, obviously, that Paris very much did not go well. It you know, to use your language, it was a near miss. It was on the verge of being a genuine catastrophe. Paris did not go well, and obviously that's where you end up with review. But it seems to me as though what the panel felt was important, and it comes through the writing of the report, is the idea of there being ongoing transparency, ongoing review for a great many number of events that then allows sort of greater information to be shared. If, for instance, on review, it's felt that an event went ever so well, people can learn from the experience positively as well, whereas the opaque nature and the unaccountable nature of organisations like UEFA have made that remarkably difficult. And that does feel as though that underpins this set of recommendations in terms of what needs to change.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you know, I represented 22 of the Hillsborough families, and I was one of the authors of the Hillsborough Law Bill. And I go around the country talking to anyone who will listen to me about the duty of candour. And so that has become a very mainstream argument. I mean, the Labour Party will have it in their forthcoming manifesto. It has widespread support, cross-party, widespread support even from the senior judiciary, and et cetera, et cetera. So it really may make it. And, it, you know, because I've done not just Hillsborough, but lots of inquiries and inquests and reviews and things, this problem, this lack of transparency problem, is a key failing in what happens after a disaster or here and near disaster. And unless there is transparency, then change just doesn't happen. So the panel adopted many of the processes that have been learned through bitter experience from Hillsborough and a range of other inquiries, and instituted a number of measures that would be familiar to anybody who has dealt with inquiry laws and reviews, and certainly in the UK, but in a wider international context. So that's why we adopted that. So right from the outset, we told all the stakeholders that we expected them to act with candor. And what that means is not just telling the truth, but proactively telling us where the problems were from their perspective, and also to produce all the documents to us that they had that were relevant to all of the issues. And then we said to them that we would publish all of the evidence, including the interview transcripts, which we'd amassed, subject to very narrow exceptions, which we, you know, properly shouldn't publish. For example, personal details which are caught by GDPR, or, for example, commercially sensitive things like the price of a contract, or security details, which you know, shouldn't go into the public domain. But beyond those narrow exceptions, we told everybody that all of the evidence would go into the public domain. And we've done very well on that. We haven't quite got everything, for reasons which I suspect you'll ask me about, but we've done pretty well on that. And therefore, the reader of this report will be able to follow the evidence for it. You look at other reports. I mean, there was a recent report into the Euro final, and reading that report, I don't know whether its conclusions are right or wrong. May well be right, but there's just no evidence or referencing there, so it doesn't really mean anything to me. So the point here is that if anybody wants to take issue with our report, then they would have to do so in the clear understanding and the light of day that the evidence that we put into the public domain alongside it, that we can show what our conclusions are based upon.
The conclusions...
Let me pick up on roll back a little bit to the earlier stage of that conversation where we were picking up on that idea of transparency and post-event review. You'll note also recommendation 15... and recommendation 20 also touch on that issue. And what we're talking about here is the idea of truth, right? Because there was a post-event analysis immediately in the wake of what happened in Paris. It was just wrong because everybody rushed to judgment. So it's not simply about this sort of issue of post-event analysis and transparency. It's also making sure that the analysis is robust. And I think that's what Pete's talking about in relationship to our review process, that we've gathered and published all of this evidence, 2,500 pages of it, that allows everybody to look at our analysis, our conclusions and our recommendations and measure them against the evidence. So what we're focusing here with 15 and 21 is that there need to be more robust measures of post-event analysis that ensure that there is a proper level of scrutiny applied. Because one of the things that we're looking at in the wake of this is how the different stakeholders kind of draw in on themselves and start attributing blame to others to defend the reputation of their own organization. And that's almost like an inherent dynamic in these situations where things go wrong. So it's about normalizing on a day-to-day basis, if you will, where these events are happening week in, week out, as they are at the moment, that these Champions League qualification events also have robust analysis around them as a kind of modus operandi for how we reflect on whether things went well or whether things went badly. And that's a key thing we want to bring out here.
Pete, you mentioned the work that you've done and continue to do, and arguments continue to be had around Hillsborough Law. It strikes me that, you know, you mentioned before the word mindset, and mindset is a word that I've sort of taken from this document. Cliff there makes mention to organisational, structural, the desire to protect first and foremost. And it feels to me as though a lot of this conversation is about there being a shift, that scrutiny and review does not have to be adversarial in the first place, and it doesn't have to be about what you do or don't give away. And the recommendations are obviously pointing at that. Part of the purpose of recommendation one is to ensure that that's ongoing. You know, Cliff there mentions 15 and 20 as well, those recommendations and how they're framed around this. It feels to me as though organisationally, and sort of from a mindset in all of our organisations, you know, I can think of examples in the United Kingdom. This is not just simply about the French or about UEFA or anything like that. That organisations getting a mindset shift, that it is okay to be reviewed. It is okay to even be reviewed harshly. That is sometimes something that is going to happen, is a mind shift that we do need to get these authority positions into as much as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a healthy organisation welcomes scrutiny. An unhealthy organization does everything it can to defend against the indefensible. And that's the bottom line. So, I mean, the whole of the Hillsborough Law project really is to establish a position where institutions, organizations, public servants can't adopt an institutionally defensive position, and they're required to act with candor. And the point that most of us involved in it keep making is that it then leads to a culture shift.
Yeah.
And if you establish within organizations the default position of people wanting to learn to do better, with a sort of gentle reminder that it might be a criminal offense if they try to hide things, then that changes the culture. But Cliff mentioned before, you know, it is a sort of inherent problem. None of us really want to admit that we've done something wrong.
Yep.
In the first place, although hopefully some of us do quickly reflect and say, well, actually, if I've done something wrong, I'll put my hands up. But there is a kind of inherent natural reaction from people. And also, you know, it comes from the history of Hillsborough, which involved a huge amount of corruption and lying. That isn't always the case. You know, there's a spectrum of why people aren't acting with candor, and sometimes there's obfuscation rather than lying as well. So it's quite a complicated issue. But unless you have provisions in place, and unless you have requirements for people to act with candor, and you have protection for whistleblowers, encourage the sort of lower ranks of organizations to call their managers out when they try to hide things, then there'll be no change. And no change in this field means death. I'm sorry to be so brutal about it, but, you know, no one listening to this podcast will have any doubt that Paris nearly involved hundreds of deaths.
The other thing that strikes
me... sorry, to let me build on that as well, because it was recommend 20 to 21, not 20, that I was referring to. But I think building on what Pete said, the other thing to recognise here is that our recommendations aren't exclusively towards UEFA, that we make that recommendation to the Council of Europe. And that recommendation is built off recognition that a kind of policing mechanism does exist. And this is the Council of Europe Monitoring Committee. And ironically enough, they actually reviewed the Stade de France in 2016 and made a whole series of recommendations that, surprise, surprise, weren't actually adopted, hence recommendation one. But what we're looking at here is that mechanism exists, but it's clearly not robust enough. that it's clearly not exercising a level of authority that's required to confront host venues and their surrounding kind of local authorities when there isn't that compliance in place, given that we understand that in the context of things going wrong, we will see these inherent difficulties. So we shouldn't lose sight of the existing framework and the existing mechanisms that are available and recognise that we need to do things to make those mechanisms more robust. Now, having some interaction with the monitoring committee and those who populate it, it's colloquially referred to as the think tank. One of the dangers here is that over the years, it's become a bit of a boys' club. You know, lots of people going around Europe, self-declared experts of safety and security operations, who have a very often very, you know, comfortable existence in that particular role, but not really exercising anything with any great authority or achieving that much by way of learning and ongoing development. So we really need to focus on the Council of Europe as well to say, well, look, what are you doing to make this more robust?
One of the recommendation two strikes me, and again, this comes through the tone of the document from the introduction all the way through, Cliff, is this idea of this, that UEFA are determined for the Champions League final to be a festival of football. I've noticed earlier in the week there's further conversation around, you know, is the Super Bowl bigger than the Champions League final? How do these things operate? This from people in, you know, either at the top of UEFA or senior in club football. And they want to have a festival of football. Recommendation 2, paragraph 9.32, reads, accordingly, supporters arriving in the host city without access to match tickets should never be understood or treated inherently as a public order problem, but facilitated as tourists who are travelling to be part of the festival the authorities are seeking to promote. And Cliff, one of the strangenesses of everything that went on in Paris, you know, it's supporters being tear gassed in the fan park, post-match being a strange aspect of this. One of the parts of this that I just think is all the way through, I'm reading the report and I'm looking at the institutional aspects and we're looking at the institutional responses. And I'm just thinking it keeps brushing up against A, human behaviour, but also B, human behaviour that is openly encouraged by UEFA in the way in which it goes about its communications and marketing. And at some sort of point, this is, they themselves have surely got to marry this up. They want their festival of football, and then they treat it like the absolute, they treat the attendees like the absolute opposite of the people who would attend the festival of football. And, you know, you've done lots and lots of work on how people behave, how crowds behave, how all of this behaves in a securitization sort of aspect. And it seems to me, until mindset shift, that if people do what you're asking them to do, you then therefore need to provide them with the support to do the very thing that you're asking them to do. And this report, and I remember the run-up to this final, I contributed I was one of the witnesses for the report, but I remember in the run-up to the final, you know, there was a lot of will there or won't there be a fan park, for instance. Yeah, that felt like, it felt like a massive thing. Will there or won't there be a fan park? When, well, of course there should be. And I think this is, you know, one of my grand frustrations is allow human behavior into your decision-making processes through all of this and look to facilitate the positive aspects of it as much as possible, especially when you're trying to market those positive aspects.
Well, I think one of the most revealing things for me in this process of the inquiry was having the opportunity to go to the minutes of some of these planning meetings. They're all in French, so I had to, you know, translate them. And it was quite a laborious exercise, but really quite revealing in terms of how they applied certain assumptions about human behaviour. So they do include human behaviour. They just make wrong assumptions about it. And that's part of the problem. So those assumptions were, from very early on, where they had recognised that both Man City and Liverpool could qualify for the final, that would then entail a large influx of so-called ticketless supporters into the city. And it was evident from those minutes that from that point onwards, they started to see that form of gathering as a public order problem and moved to a strategic position of control, what we call a public order approach rather than a facilitation approach. So recommendation 2 is really about re-emphasizing the need to take correct assumptions about how you need to deal with crowds in relationship to your overall strategic position. You need to move away from the idea that crowds or football fans are inherently disorderly towards the idea that your role, your duty and your responsibility is to facilitate the peaceful assembly of people who want to come and express and celebrate their identity and enjoy this carnival of football. And it's really quite shocking that we have to re-emphasise that at this stage after all of the learning that's gone on. But
to UEFA.
Well, yeah, to UEFA, but it's not just to UEFA, because the people that were making those assumptions were the French authorities. But that flows into this core recommendation that we've got, that was possible because of the failure of UEFA oversight. And that's the issue, that UEFA just rolled back and let this obvious problem start to develop that was so contrary to what everybody knows should have been the case, and they did nothing about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And through the interviews with UEFA, there was an ambivalence about this festival of football notion that they were, whenever we referred to the festival of football, oh, yes, absolutely, festival of football. But then we had the not just the ambivalence about whether there was going to be fan zones, but once the fan zones were there, there was a very, very late notification that the match was going to be shown at those fan zones. And so it seemed that, UEFA were hopping from one foot to the other about the engagement with supporters rather than embracing it. And they're still sort of talking about encouraging clubs to put the match on at their home grounds, for example, so that supporters won't travel to away, to
finals
elsewhere. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad idea, frankly, for home screening of the match. But it's the mindset behind it, and there's that ambivalence. So, recommendation two shouldn't really be necessary. And I suspect UEFA will say that, but I think it is necessary. I think it was right that the panel put it in there, and I think it is key that UEFA take it on board. And as Cliff says, when they spot or should spot the public authorities taking an opposite approach, they should then escalate that. They should tell them that that isn't good enough. And if it doesn't change, they should escalate it through the system.
Neil, if I may as well, we just had, I think it's relevant to talk about a very revealing interview we had with the deputy mayor of the local arrondissement where the Liverpool fan park was. And what was interesting about that interview was his view of the way that the police imposed that fan park on the local environment and ended up fencing it in. Now, as a local authority mayor, he couldn't get his head around why it was fenced in. They didn't want it fenced in. They felt it turned it into a kind of fortress. It cut it off from the local community, and it made problematic the whole relationship that they had with the fans inside the zone. Now, my view is that it was fenced off because the police saw the fan park not as a way of facilitating fans, but a way of controlling them so that they would then not subsequently present the public order problem that the police assumed that they would if they hadn't the means to fence them in and control them. And that's really revelatory from my point of view about how this perspective permeated out into every different aspect of the operation.
Members of the local community were dancing outside the railings of where the Liverpool fan park was, outside the fencing in. We went for something to eat, which was remarkably difficult to do in the fan park. And everyone, the local community that certainly was out and about, was having a whale of a time, but obviously couldn't commune with the central event. That was the experience before our very eyes. I want to talk about recommendations 10, 11 and 12, Cliff. And within there, going back to this idea of duties of candor, that part of involving, so for instance, recommendation 11 refers to defined supporter liaison officers and then being part of the process of helping plan, create plan events with event organisers and so on. Also in there as well is the FSE, Football Supporters Europe. There was problems that they predicted, but that there's a recommendation that them and the affiliated organisations are part of it. There is one in general around the communication, the message. And my point here is that organizations choosing to be opaque in advance, almost, because they will be opaque in the aftermath, is part of why there isn't greater involvement for these sorts of stakeholders, that no one wants to open the doors. Because once you've opened the doors, there's the idea that at some sort of point, someone may well point out other issues or questions. And it's part of why this is a mindset conversation, the mindset that all of this is closed off. And recommendations 10, 11, and 12 are very much about trying to shift that mindset.
Yeah, definitely. And it flows from recommendation two that, you know, when we think about the way that we try to push the authorities in their overall approach to the management of crowd events, we talk about models of policing that are based on facilitation and dialogue. That dialogue is a central component of how you achieve success here. It gives you information, it helps you understand people's legitimate intentions, it helps you then to facilitate those legitimate intentions. That flows into an environment that is conducive to self-regulation and reduces the overall problems that you're going to encounter. But in order to achieve that dialogue with large fan communities, you have to have processes and mechanisms in place. And we have those. We have those in the form of these really sophisticated and advanced supporter organisations. So in the context of Liverpool, we've got several of them that are very adept at communicating and understanding and engaging and professional in that endeavour. We've also got these organisations like the Football Supporters Association, the FSE. And we've also got this directive from UEFA themselves about ensuring that every club has a supporter liaison officer. And that, if it was embraced and developed and enhanced, would create that pattern of engagement and opportunity. But as you point out, underneath it all is still this assumption on the part of powerful groups in this environment that fans are part of the problem, not part of the solution. And that's what we need to confront.
You mentioned their supporter liaison, you mentioned Spirit of Shankly, you mentioned FSE, FSA. You know, to go back to the Saint-Denis agreements, and this is one of the things that strikes me, you know, Article 8, as we discussed earlier on, explicitly says key stakeholders, proactive regular communications, key stakeholders, supporter representatives, local communities, based on the principle of dialogue. And I feel at times, Cliff, as a supporter and as someone who is engaged in these matters to a degree, like, I feel as though, from a supporter point of view at times, I feel as though we couldn't be making it any easier for them. We couldn't be being any more available, couldn't be being any more accommodating. As you say, there's huge levels of professionalism within all of this. And the fact that this isn't used, and then when it is used, or when it comes in after the fact, it's rejected, it's, you know, there's the obfuscation process, there's the idea that you don't get everything. You know, for me, this is one of the great frustrations, is that everyone couldn't be trying any harder on the side of football supporters to make this stuff as easy and straightforward as possible for the authorities.
Yeah, it's just not set up to accommodate it. I think for me, one of the directions of travel that I want to push is also the role of the UK police delegation and what they do in terms of facilitating and engaging, because still that model in the European context is working on the spotter idea. You know, their job is to identify so-called risk or hooligan fans and feed that information up, rather than having a framework of dialogue and communication to enhance the connections between the police organisation and the supporter organisations, primarily through the SLO. And we've seen really good examples of that working, for example, in the Swedish context. But it does require the clubs to have a particular model of SLOs. Too often those SLOs are located in the marketing department, rather than part of their safety and security operations.
Yeah.
And again, there needs to be points of contact in the police. I mean, if the French police, the Paris police, they're notoriously heavy-handed, not just in relationship to football, but everything else.
Yeah.
So they simply don't have that point of contact. They don't have dialogue officers. There's nobody there to talk to. So as you say, yeah, we're making it really easy for them. But even in that context, given the lack of mechanism for these organisations to engage, it's simply even then still impossible to achieve.
Just to begin to sum up, Pete, you mentioned before about not getting everything, and this still remains a problem. There's still people in post, there's still a mindset, and it's what to be done about that mindset that I think does permeate. There's still not been, at least up to the point at which I last checked before recording this, an official response from UEFA to this report. When you think about not getting everything, is there anything in particular that was particularly frustrating in the process?
I think probably the pushback about, UEFA blamed the voiceless. They treat the supporters as a an easy target, really, and the great unwashed. They're, you know, as we know, the, one of the shocking similarities with Hillsborough was before the evening was over, UEFA were putting out a media release blaming supporters. And that, I think, is key in the discussion you've just had with Cliff about engagement with supporters and how really there's some pretty straightforward, easy things that they could do. Is the way that the mindset must be changed. And their communications are some very straightforward things that are all in the report about communicating with supporters, arriving at the game by a variety of different methods, deployment of Liverpool stewards more intelligently outside of the stadium, for example, all of those sorts of issues. But you know, we have this institutional defensiveness whereby UEFA don't think they did anything wrong. That's where that they came to the table with that kind of mindset. I can only hope that wiser heads will prevail. And I hope there'll be a lot of pressure on them from clubs, from supporter organisations, from sponsors, from broadcasters, from you, the wider media. And I hope that wiser heads in UEFA will prevail, but we'll have to see. But you're right, there hasn't been a full acceptance of the report as we speak, which I find a little depressing. But they haven't contradicted it either, so let's look at it glass half full.
Shall we agree to reconvene on May the 9th? Reconvene on May the 9th? This is on air, by the way, so if you're away, just say so, Cliff. Don't worry about what I'm saying. We've got May the 8th. Let's give them May the 8th and let's have a chat on May the 9th and see how we've got on.
But more than happy to do that. I was just reflecting on it's often a conversation that Pete and I have had during this process. But he's definitely a glass half full, whereas I'm definitely a glass half empty kind of guy. So I was just reflecting what we were actually going to be talking about on May the 9th. But more than happy to be there.
Well, I think that there is progress. I mean, you know, your work, Cliff, over the years, you know, has started to turn the supertanker around. I mean, going, you know, we're both old enough to remember the dark days where policing at the end of a truncheon was just normal. And that has begun to change. And so, yeah, I do have some confidence with it. And, you know, I keep going on about Hillsborough law and candor and stuff like that. You know, if we had a bit longer, I could tell you quite a lot of positives that have come out of that, and in inquiries that I've been involved in, that the lessons from Hillsborough have made a difference. So there is progress. I mean, frankly, otherwise I wouldn't bother.
I'm going to get Pete on every week. You can tell me about all the progress stuff as we go, all the way through. He's more than welcome anytime. There will be more from Pete, there'll be more from Cliff, there'll be more from everybody on this. The report's terrific. Do read it. The recommendations are genuinely excellent towards the end. It does offer a pathway forward. People have just got to opt into taking it. Sports Social Podcast Network.